By cracky, here he comes. The colonel, that is.
Oh, yeah, another character. I don't know where the characters come from on this program. I mean, we attract some characters. So, welcome back. The second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow, here on the Science News Radio Network. Exploring the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. Happy to have you. In just a minute, we have back with us an old friend, Deb Newberry, the author of The Next Big Thing is Really Small, and you probably remember her if you're an old hand around here. We've had her on the program numerous times. Well, Deb has spent the past year studying the nanoprofessor, which is the equipment and the curriculum that you heard spoken about in the previous half hour by Tom Levesque, and how it is educating kids from the slums in Colombia. I mean, these are kids with hardly clothes on their back or shoes on their feet. They're learning the uses of nanotechnology. Just remarkable stuff. So Deb has been studying it, and she's brought it into her college, Dakota College in Minneapolis, and she's going to bring us up to date on how it's being received there. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. People tell us that this is really a favorite part of the program. So right now, though, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we have here in the set to answer today's query.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help you?
Okay, O Spirit of the Fountain, here is today's query. What is circled by Titan, Phoebe, and Pan?
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell the others.
Well, the answer to the question of what is circled by Titan, Phoebe, and Pan is Saturn, the planet Saturn. All right, well, today we finally have our old friend Deb Newberry back with us again, and we've been trying to get her for a long time. But, Deb, I guess you've been real busy with the end of the school year up there at Dakota College, and that's probably been the big problem. But welcome back. So good to have you.
Oh, thank you. I enjoy speaking with you, and it's a pleasure to have an opportunity to give you an update.
Well, I'm going to want an update. I was lucky enough to be invited to speak to the Public Affairs Luncheon Club today, and this is an old line club of Dallas people that are highly educated and very influential, and they want to know all about nanotechnology, and they want to know about the nano professor. And I said, well, we're going to get up to date on that, because I'm talking to Deb Newberry this very afternoon, and we're going to do a show on it. So tell me, how is it going with the nano professor?
Just wonderful. The students are so excited. Let me just remind you what the nano professor is.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a combination of equipment and educational materials. So it has in the suite three pieces of equipment that are centered around the dip pen lithography tool that is created and developed by Nano Inc. in Chicago. And then in addition to that, they have beautiful laboratory exercises activities. There's nine of them that are written up that go along with the suite of equipment. And in addition to that, there is curriculum, six chapters of very well-written content, textbook-type material that the students can use. And let me tell you, sir, it is so exciting to watch the students get involved and start figuring out and working together and trying to create new materials by themselves. And what I mean by that is, when we talked in the past, I've shared with you that one of the challenges of nanotechnology is being able for anyone to get the concept of just how small an atom is, or a molecule, how very tiny these things are. You cannot see them with your eyes. And within this suite of equipment that the nano professor provides, we have an atomic force microscope. We also have the dip pen lithography machine, which allows us to make and create patterns and designs that are smaller than our eyes can see, even the good eyes of my young students, you know, not so much my old eyes, but even the students' eyes can't see them. And by creating these very small designs or patterns, we can then shine a light on them, and we can create the rainbow effect that you get when you look at a compact disc, a CD, in different angles of light, or even when you look at an oil film on top of water. And so it's opening brand new doors of understanding the concepts that traditionally we have to just kind of hand wave, and you've got some PowerPoints and you draw pictures on the board, and you, as an educator, you jump up and down to try and explain these concepts to the students. And using the Nano Professor, they are just right in there asking questions, developing new inks, developing new patterns all on their own. It is unbelievable watching what they're doing.
So they're really learning nanotechnology right from the very essence of the atoms itself. And one of the questions kept coming up today is, what possible use is this stuff going to be for?
Oh my goodness! Let's see, how long of a conversation are we allowed to have?
We need to just talk about and talk.
Yeah, it is. One of the things that is most exciting to me that is possible with the Nano Professor is to use the patterns that you create as either chemical or biological sensors or detectors, if you will. Imagine being able to put a whole bunch of dots on a piece of paper. I'm talking at the macro scale right now, but we've got, say, 10,000 dots. And every 2,000 of those dots we've designed so that they can register perhaps the amount of red blood cells or the amount of oxygen in your blood, or if we're talking about an air sensor, or, oh, what's even better, how about sensing water and the impurities that are in water, so we can look for the horrible things that you hope you never find, like arsenic and lead and all that type of thing, but you can also look for bacteria or maybe even just particulate dust or dirt or, you know, that type of those types of materials that can get into water. Well, you can create, by using this series of dots, you could create, think of something like a popsicle stick that has 10,000 dots on the end of it that you can't see. You can't see those 10,000 dots, but you take that popsicle stick, you dip it into your glass of water, you pull it out, and places where you might see red or green or blue or yellow areas would say, ooh, you might have some bacteria in that water that you're just about to drink. So in creating sensors, and the thing is, students can do this. It doesn't take a rocket scientist or a PhD or anyone. Students, we can create those types of sensor systems for first year students and their capability and their knowledge level. Now, the cool thing, and I'm not even going to let you ask a question, am I? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But the cool thing is, from an educator standpoint, mm-hmm. all I have to do is guide them and gently lead them with questions like, oh, how are we going to make sure that our dots, our sensing dots, are going to adhere to the surface? How do we measure them? How do we perhaps cure them? And so that, just by asking that simple question, you all of a sudden open the door, well, what's the chemistry of the material of these dots that we're putting down? What's the chemistry of the surface that we're putting them on? What is the material that we're going to be dipping them in? For example, you don't want to make a whole bunch of dots that are washable, that are going to wash away in water. Even if the dots adhere to my popsicle stick, if they wash away in water, that's not going to be a very good detector. So all of a sudden, you are very subtly introducing students to this 360-degree angle aspect of things that you have to take into consideration. And so that's why I kind of struggle to define the lab activities that are created with the Nano Professor, because there's so much more. traditionally you may think of a, you know, you go into chemistry lab, you go into physics lab, your teacher hands you this thing, it says, these are the materials you need, here is step one, here is step two, measure these things, write it down in this graph, and you kind of, you go through that, and there's all you, if you can read and follow instructions, you're going to do just fine in the lab. This one, granted, are very well written, the activities are very well written, but just at every stage, there's an opportunity to expand it, to learn more, to have the students work in teams, to do design of experiments. The opportunities are just exponential. It is no longer your traditional chemistry, physics, material science lab.
Well, you know, I was talking to Tom Levesque a little earlier, and he was telling us about Columbia. The country of Columbia has put four of these units in, and they're teaching kids, slum kids, kids with no shoes and hardly enough to eat, coming out of the hills into the classroom and being able to work with a nano professor in Columbia. And he said it's the most remarkable thing to see the enlightened kids who are entering a whole new world that they never dreamed existed.
Yep, and I think that is part of the beauty of the ease of use of this equipment. And what it does is it causes both the instructors and the students and the parents of the students to say, gee, what's really going on there? Why does that happen? And in my book, anytime you can get anyone, whether it's the Rotary Club or third graders or their parents or my grandmother, to say, why does it do that? Man, I get a great big star. If they ask that three-letter word, you know, why is that happening? Boy, you have just taken a giant step toward teaching independent of where they're starting from, what foundational knowledge that they may have. Anybody, if you can get someone to say, why is that happening, then you're halfway there. And I think that also, again, you know, whether they have shoes, whether they have shoes on their feet or their educational foundation, this set of tools, the nanoprofessor system, is going to allow students to experience the wonder of science, and I hope just fill their minds with all kinds of questions and give them some answers and get some excitement, because once you've got that energy going, nothing is going to stop those kids, whether they're barefoot or not. You know, it is just the spark that can get a whole flame going for the rest of their lives, and so it's really very, very exciting.
Of course, we're told that by the year 2015 that we need 5 million workers in nanotechnology in the world. I guess we have about 20,000 right at the moment. Are you still hearing those figures?
Yeah, I keep going, are we still on track? Is that still true? And just last week, I had a meeting with the Dakota County Technical College Nano Program Industry Advisory Board, mm-hmm. and right, it's a board that is comprised of about 10 to 12 local companies from everything from material science to biotechnology to electronics to coatings and that sort of thing, and they are all saying, validating that, because that's one of the first questions I ask every quarter when this group gets together. Well, do you still need my students? And the answer is yes. And it's growing, and every time I turn around, I find more companies that are starting that will call me and say, boy, I didn't even know you had a program that, you know, that trained people like this. So I personally believe that the need is still there, and it's as valid and as large as it was 5 or 6 years ago when Dr. Rocco first started talking about the need for nano-savvy employees, or, you know, people that understand nanotechnology. And the hard part is getting over that phobia that it involves the word science or technology. You know, I try not to even talk about nanoscience when I'm talking to high school students initially, because they will shut down as soon as they hear the word science. And the nano professor, again, you can show them something that they can't see, but I can take a laser on it and I can create a rainbow on a surface that looks perfectly smooth. And the reason I can do it is because I created something using dip pen lithography, which, oh, by the way, dip pen lithography is nanotechnology. Would you like to learn a little bit more about it? Would you like to come up and make one of these?
Well, just before we go any further, you mentioned Dr. Rocco, and we need to explain to the listeners who he is for those who don't know him.
He is, oh golly, many people call him the father of the National Nanotechnology Initiative. Mikhail Rocco has been around the National Science Foundation for a long time, and back in the mid-90s, he and James von Ayer, who is Zyvex Corporation down in Richardson, Texas, and Rick Smalley from Rice University, so lots of nice Texas connections there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as early as the mid-80s and into the 1990 or so, Rocco was looking at nanotechnology and how can we get it from the research into more mainstream education. And over time through the 90s, he kept lobbying Congress and whoever he could, as well as the science organizations, NIST and the National Science Foundation. And then in the late 1990s, he was the one who truly took the National Nanotechnology Initiative from a government entity that is funded on a yearly basis to something that becomes a traditional line item in the budget. And so a lot of us look at him as the founding father of nanotechnology, and because of his efforts, a lot of what we've been talking about over the last year and a half or so have come to fruition.
Okay, now you've been a pioneer with this nano professor by Nano Inc., and so it's been crucial to follow all the way along the line about how that has happened. Now, last year this time when I spoke to you, you were getting trained in it, I believe. You were in Chicago, weren't you, learning how to use it?
Boy, good memory. Yes, I was getting trained in how to use the Nano Professor suite of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened between like May and November last year was myself and John Ireland at Nano Inc. and a couple other of the Nano Inc. Scientists, predominantly John and I, spent a lot of time playing with the equipment. And playing, even though that's a bad word for scientists to use, but oh, we just had a ball trying to create these experiments or activities that the students are going through now. And so we spent a lot of time really trying to figure out which ink works on which surface and these design of experiments and all the different ways that this tool can be used. So it really took John and I a while of getting comfortable with it, or not comfortable, but aware of all of the possibilities. And then in December, the complete suite of equipment with all the consumables and everything was delivered to me. And so I've been working with 8 students since January doing these experiments, learning the equipment. And man, these students are just amazing. I'm over helping or talking to one group, you know, one pair of students, and then all of a sudden I look over and I go, wow, what are you guys doing? Well, we've increased the humidity and we're writing with this ink on a gold surface, and this is what we're doing, and oh, look at what we did. We made it write this. And I'm just going, holy cow, document that. Tell me what you did so other students can do it. But they just jump in.
Deb Newberry, the author of The Next Big Thing Is Really Small, administering the Nano Professor at Dakota College in Minneapolis. Thanks, Deb. I appreciate it so much, darling. Bye-bye. Well, we always like to hear from listeners, and after last week's program, we had some comments emailed to us on the things that Jeff Chapman said on the program when he said the West must share its technology with China. Coal-fired power stations there are a massive problem to the rest of the world. That was the words of Jeff Chapman from London, as a matter of fact. First, we heard from David Ellis. He's the Director of Technology, Marketing, and Development at the Plano Economic Development Board. And he writes, I agree that it would benefit the world if China implemented clean coal technologies. If the Chinese want the technologies, they will get it either by corporate espionage or purchase. And I guess it wasn't made clear, or people didn't know that it was made clear, that that Jeff Chapman wants to sell the technology to the Chinese and not just give it to them. Because we got another communication from Michael Lamb. He emailed us. He's a pollution specialist in Austin, Texas. He emailed us, Colonel, you're assuming that CO2 is bad. It's not a pollutant. My plants, my garden, trees, and grass need it to survive. Coal dust is bad, and so is SO2, and they need to be treated. You're being used as a tool to spread false information and harm our nation and our economy. Jeff Chapman and Al Gore stand to make billions of dollars from this false emergency they're trying to generate. Are you in that money-making group if this false science is adopted? I think maybe so. Furthermore, you cannot take patented technology and give it to the Chinese without licensing it from the owner, or are you condoning stealing property to save the earth now? Besides, if the Chinese want the technology, they will steal it like they do every day from our companies here in America. You have nothing to talk about except false science and political rhetoric that involves stealing money from Americans and giving it to the rest of the world. Get a clue and get out, or I'm sorry, check out the stuff you're putting out. That's from Michael Lamb, pollution specialist in Austin, Texas. Well, as I say, I think Jeff Chapman wants to sell the technology to the Chinese. He just thinks it's really important to get busy and to do it. I have no monetary interest in what happens with green technology. I do not deal in carbon trading. In fact, as I've spoken about many times in this program, against cap and trade, I'm still not convinced it's a thing that we need to do, and I think it can hurt us really badly, and those of you who listen all the time know that. As a matter of fact, we were pretty tough on Al Gore in a series we did on climate change last September and October, and we, as a matter of fact, on this program, broke what was to become the ClimateGate scandal 3 months before the mainstream press got to it. So I just want to clear those things up. Thanks, Michael and David. I hope you keep listening, and I hope we hear from you again.
And now we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
People say, oh, you're in nuclear energy. That's so wonderful. Well, I would just say, if you contemplate this as a career, be prepared for the lows as well as the highs. I was hired on this campus about 2 months before Three Mile Island, and you might say that my career has been downhill ever since. And on the other hand, suddenly, we're great guys. Suddenly at the cocktail parties and whatnot, people say, oh, you're in nuclear energy. That's so wonderful, sort of. So you can't let that, you know, cloud your thinking. It just is a good long-term solution for everyone, and I've sort of known that all along, and sometimes I've been popular and sometimes I've been unpopular with that attitude, and I'm glad that I can walk down the street without getting mugged. My name is Edward Morse, and I'm a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, in the Department of Nuclear Engineering.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
You'll live tomorrow, 'cause you know it will be there. I am waiting for you. Oh.